M&K Talk YA now presents The Star Touched Queen, Part 1 by Roshini Chakshi.
M&K Talk YA.
I'm Marissa Snyder.
And I'm Katie Bradford.
And this is our young adult fiction podcast. And this week we started our last series of the year. We are reading The Star-Touched Queen by Roshini Chakshi. And we read halfway through the first book, which was chapter 17, which was called A Fine Legacy.
And again, I feel like we got really lucky because we always just kind of look for a halfway chapter number since we haven't usually read the books. And I feel like this one stopped at a great spot again.
Perfect.
Like the halfway point was like, oh, I couldn't have planned it better. I mean, I don't know what's coming next, but
we didn't really plan it. We literally just like crack the book in half and find a halfway point and say, here you go.
Yeah, like the last word we read, death. Just But yeah, I didn't know much about this series before we started. I think you had found this one or brought it up to me at least. But I feel like it's already a lot different than I was expecting. Not in a bad way, just in a, I don't know, I was expecting different.
I agree. I wasn't really sure what to expect either, but I'm really enjoying the world so far. And I think it feels different from the other worlds we've been in.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that there's some unfamiliar stuff to me that is interesting. So it seems like it's based in like a fantasy version of India or something similar to that. And there's mm-hmm. a lot of Hindu mythology mixed into it too. So that's what I like is like, it feels like it does have some claws in the real world, but there's also a whole different level of fantasy going on. And I like that.
Yeah, I agree. And it, especially because we're in like a magical world right now, at least recently we've been in this kingdom, Acheron, and there's like so much magic. Anything's possible, it almost feels like, in this world, right? Like different rooms have different rules and different like experiences, and our main character is still figuring things out, Maya, and it still feels like the real world is like kind of where she started.
It's like familiar, but also fantastical, which I like.
Yes.
The magic system, right away, that's like what I was focusing on, because you know how I feel about like undefined magic systems. So far, we haven't really learned a lot about the magic, but I like the idea that it's kind of based on karma and reincarnation and, you know, that sort of belief. So I have high hopes that this magic system is going to make more sense than some of the other books we've read.
Yep. The other thing I really like is I still think Lonnie Taylor is like the queen of this, so I don't know that I'd necessarily, it's not necessarily fair to like super compare, but I feel like she writes kind of similarly with like, just like, I feel like she's very intentional with a lot of her word choice and uses kind of like, just like beautiful language to also help, like the way she talks helps set the scene as well, like this kind of mystical world.
I agree with you. I noticed that right away. Like the writing is very beautiful and it's very descriptive and it's like poetic in a way.
Yes.
Which I kind of like. And like, I think there's a really fine line between overdoing that to the point where the language becomes like too flowery and you feel like the writer's maybe trying too hard. And I didn't get that feeling with this book. I felt like it was just really well done and really kind of natural sounding, but also, like you said, it felt very thoughtful, which I really liked.
Yeah, just like she put a lot of intention behind just like the word choice. So to your point, she didn't just throw in sentences because they were pretty, but she made sure the sentences she mm-hmm. had to put in anyways came out pretty or something.
Yeah, and I think we don't get that too often. Like, I think a lot of YA fantasies tend to be really plot-driven or really character-driven, and there's mm-hmm. not, you don't read it and think like, oh, that was beautiful, but you kind of get those moments here. Okay, so this book opens in the court of Bharata with our main character Maya, and she's attending a funeral procession.
Oh yeah, I actually already forgot about that scene. It was a good way to start though, because it gave you a sense of kind of her role in the court and her relationship mm-hmm. with her father and other people in the court. So she is, her father's the king, but she's one of many of his offspring in the, what do they call it? Why can't I think of the word?
The harem?
Yeah, the harem. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I was like, the dowry? No, that's the wrong word. the harem with all of his wives and other unmarried children, or like younger children and unmarried daughters.
Half-sisters. Yep. Yeah.
But she is, her mother has already died, and she's been blamed for this, the recent funeral, another one of the wives, because we find out she's basically like cursed, not cursed, but her horoscope, her star chart from when she was born predicted that her marriage would bring death and destruction, or she'd bring death and destruction, or
she would partner with death.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a very, very bad horoscope.
So everyone is suspicious that she's like, anytime something bad goes wrong, it seems like she's getting blamed for it, and like no one wants to get close to her, and there's just like a lot of whispering and not a lot of love for her in the court as a whole.
Absolutely, yeah. And the especially the main highest ranking woman in the harem, Mother Dina, she was very bitter enemies with Maya's mother, we learn.
I am curious to hear more about her mother, for sure.
Yeah, me too. And I think it's interesting this, we learn that Mother Dina actually lost a lot of children, mm-hmm. and she blames Maya for all of her children who died. She kind of feels like she's responsible, just her presence, they feel, brings like bad energy or just like creates destruction wherever she goes. Mm-hmm. So this main character is such a scapegoat right now for like everything that goes wrong. Basically everyone's pointing fingers at her. Mm-hmm. But then we learn later on that Maya's father, the Raja, he decides that he's going to use her to try and end his war that has been going on for an unspecified period of time. But essentially, there's like rebel armies who have been fighting, waging war against the Raja and his empire. And he decides that Maya would be a good pawn, I guess, in his plan to kind of end the war. So he originally says he's going to marry her off to end the war. And he invited all of the rebel leaders as suitors for her hand.
Then he changes the plan a little bit.
A lot.
And she's already upset. So even with the original plan, so she also has been like spying on her dad for years, and he knew that, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. I feel like that relationship, her and her father could have, and maybe we'll see more of it still, but was sort of an interesting one that in some ways was over too soon, but it's okay. But she's already upset because she, with her curse and everything, just assumed that she'd kind of, even though she'd never have like friends in the court, would sort of have a life of freedom within the court to an extent, because she'd never be married and she'd just grow up and like work in the temple or work as a scholar or do something kind of like just have some freedom, because she was never considered like a wife material, right?
Exactly.
And so she's already just upset that like this freedom has been taken away from her, and is like planning to escape and all this stuff before he even changes the plan, which he does drastically.
And what's interesting too is like you get at the very beginning, when you see the Raja, like, in his funeral procession, and he has, like, that necklace with, like, a stone for every child he's fathered or whatever. And you even hear from Maya where she's just like, yeah, I'm just another stone in his necklace. Like, he doesn't know me from any of the other children in the harem. But then you get that mm-hmm. moment when he tells her that he's going to marry her off, where you get a sense that he actually knows her a little bit better than you think, and even than Maya thought, because he's like, yeah, I knew you were spying on me in the rafters. Like, I can tell you have scholarly pursuits. Like, he...
I trust you to make this decision. Like, yeah, he seemed to, like, recognize and respect something in her.
Right. But then, even after that, he says, even a favored daughter is still just a daughter. And that was, like, that quote, like, really stuck out to me, because he was like, yeah, even yep. though I may have noticed you more than the others, like, you're still just a pawn.
And it says so much about the world, too, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's, like, little things like this that the author put in, like, really sets the tone for, like, how women are expected to behave and the society that she lives in.
Yep.
But then her father, so he invites all of these suitors from the rebel armies, and then he comes to visit Maya and brings her a vial of poison and says, hey, so I've changed the plan a little bit, and I know that
just
no
a little
matter who you marry, the rebels are still gonna wage war, but if you poison yourself, your death will basically make, it'll like nullify the bonds of hospitality, I think is what he says. And then we can kill all the rebels. So we're basically using you as bait to like lure all of the rebels into the palace, and then we'll slaughter them all. But you have to die.
What do you think that was his plan all along? Or do you think it really was because he found out that the rebels were going to attack regardless? Like, do you think he originally was just planning to marry her off? Or do you think he always thought she was just bait and was just waiting to tell her?
I mean, does it matter? Like, he made the decision anyway. No. And, like, basically told her, you're completely dispensable to me. And I really just need you to do this because you're a pawn and I have no other use for you.
Yep. But she does agree. I mean, she ultimately, I mean, she doesn't like it by any means. And she even says, like, I'm not going to do this for you. And he's like, I'm not, you, I know you won't do it for me, but you'll do it for, like, the people.
And especially her half-sister, Gari.
Mm-hmm. The only person who's, like, been nice to her.
Yeah. So basically, everything she does is because of Gari. And then, luckily, at the last minute, she's interrupted by the Raja of Acheron, whose name is Amar. And he basically tells her, like, hey, don't do that, because all of the rebels actually brought their armies with them, and they're just hiding under their chariots waiting to attack you. Which is kind of like Trojan horse, Troy kind of situation.
Yeah. And maybe we should have predicted it. But okay.
Yeah. Like, if you were planning on slaughtering all these people, like, didn't you maybe think that they would catch on to that too? Or like have their own counter plan? Probably.
Backup plan. Yeah. So not only do you not have to kill yourself because this war has already come, basically, but like your home is being attacked. So I'm going to like take you away. And then she kind of in a surprise move a little bit goes ahead and like does the marriage ceremony thing, right? Because she throws her flower garland around his neck.
Yep. This is actually part of my research this week. So they did Swayamvara, which is the marriage ceremony where they invited all of the suitors.
Multiple suitors or whatever.
Yeah. Which was kind of interesting because I was like, oh, that's actually a little bit different from an arranged marriage, because I mean, it is still arranged, like you're still picking the suitors who are present, but in a Svayamvara, the bride has...
You have some say.
Yeah, she has,
you have some power.
Option to choose who she wants out of the select people. So I thought that was really interesting, and I kind of was like, oh, that's at least a little bit more freedom than I thought you were going to get.
True.
Still not very much, but so yeah, she does put the garland around Amar's neck, so they escape together. And this is where the book gets really cool.
Well, and just even before this, so we talked a little bit about her only friend or sister, Gari, who's like the younger girl, half-sister, who loves her and like comes by every night for stories, and they just have such a strong bond. And we hear one of the stories, or at least we hear some references to some of that, and she sort of takes like the myths and legends that she's learned about and tells them to her half-sister, but she also has like embellished or made certain things up that like aren't from the books or aren't from the story. And what's really interesting is part of the stuff she's made up is what she ends up seeing, right?
Yeah, which I thought that was really cool. It was like a great way to introduce the idea of like the Night Bazaar and the other world and those concepts. So we're prepared for it when we finally get there. It's not just like out of nowhere, like, where are we? Oh, this is the, you know, Night Bazaar. Like, that would have been kind of clumsy. That was like a good setup, I felt.
Well, and I love that it was not even necessarily just a legend that she retold, but it was some, like, some of it is stuff that she just made up. Because we also, so we sort of are under the impression that this, she's become a scapegoat because of the star chart, but she also mentions a few times in her life where, like, she's wished for something bad to happen to someone, and it has. She doesn't, like, actually believe she has powers, or she doesn't really believe that it's related to her horoscope, and while reading it initially, you don't really either necessarily, but there is something there about her wanting things or her saying things or thinking things or imagining things and them coming true, right?
Yeah. She said, like, sometimes my wishes have a strange way of coming true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I liked the whole idea of, like, karma in this book, and I actually really liked, there was, like, I don't remember who said it, but someone was reflecting on the fact that, like, the idea of karma makes good deeds appear suspect.
Yeah, I think it was her. I think it was Maya.
Yeah, and I had, like, never thought of it that way before, but I was like, that's so interesting. Like, she basically was like, I see people, like, giving alms to the poor or, like, helping people in the street or whatever, and they're doing it because they believe that if they do that, they will be reborn into a better life. You know, they'll be like reincarnated mm-hmm. to a higher state. So it's all about like doing good in this world so you can be better in your next life. But like, it also is so true, like no one's doing it out of just the kindness of their heart. Like they're doing it for themselves in a way, which is like, I never really thought about karma that way.
Well, it's interesting. There's even, I think there's a story in the Bible that's kind of like that too, or where they're talking about like, you don't do good things and then like go around and like publicize them. Like you should do good things without the recognition. But like, you know, back in like biblical times or whatever, when people were like, oh, look, I'm a good person. Like I'm giving alms to the poor. Or I'm like doing this act of service, or I'm helping these people. But if you're like proud of it or like publicizing it, it sort of undoes the selfish aspect of it. And I feel like it's something kind of similar here with what she was mm-hmm. saying about the karma thing too. And it is really interesting because it's like intention matters, but so does you don't want people to not do good deeds just because they exactly. have a bad reason for doing good deeds. But you also, like, it's sort of this, like, well, chicken and the egg or catch 22, or I don't even know, but like something just, it's a little goofy.
Yeah, like if you get good results, does it matter really what your intentions were if you still end up doing the work? Yeah.
Yeah. But no, I agree. I like that too. And I like how this whole book in a way is sort of about shifting perspective or thinking about things from a different way or from a different angle. And I think that was one of the early examples of her doing that just naturally in her life, even though now it's like a lot of the tests that are happening when she ends up at Acheron. But yeah, there's a lot about like, oh, don't just like accept the way everyone's told you things should be. Like, don't accept that like people are doing good deeds because they're good people. mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this karma idea too, and the reincarnation idea, because do you think the whole like the intruder, we didn't even talk about this, but so she... Oh, yeah. Had like a tutor who was doing some creepy things.
Turned into a demon.
Yeah. And then when she was about to escape, there was like some demon-like thing or some kind of intruder that came into her room. And they both kind of alluded to recognizing her or like being mm-hmm. surprised that it was truly her. And with this reincarnation idea and everything, it sort of feels like maybe it's whoever she was in a previous life, right?
Yeah, because the female demon in her room said she needs Maya to lead her.
Yeah.
And I was like, ooh, lead you where? But I didn't think about the demons. So you think the demons are Maya in a past life?
I don't think they're her in a past life, but I think they're recognizing whoever she was in a past. Like, they're recognizing her soul. So, like, she maybe doesn't remember her previous life, which is why she's like, this is just weird. But they, like, have met her, and they're like, oh, it's you. Like, it's the same soul.
Yeah.
And even her husband now, because he seems to already know her or like remember her or recognize her. And she has these moments of almost, she keeps referring to it as like when you wake up from sleep and something's like just, like you're just remembering a dream or you're just forgetting a dream. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there's something there with the reincarnation aspect and who she was before, what she was capable of that she's forgotten. And we see even that tree of memories or whatever, where it's someone different, but she knows it was her.
Yeah. It was like, it was a tree with all of her memories. And one of the memories was her with a girl called Nariti.
Yeah. Which reminded me of her sister.
Her other half-sister, Gari, yeah. So, yeah, I'm super curious about that.
Sorry, I, like, totally jumped all over the place.
Let's talk about Amar.
Okay.
So, what do we think about him?
So, he came in and saved the day and took her to a magical world and is, like, crazy obsessed with her, kind of, but also keeping all sorts of secrets because he physically is incapable of telling her certain things. So he's just asking her to trust him.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that he says he wants her perspective and her honesty, which is like, I would feel that would be like very refreshing coming from a culture where I feel like probably all men want is like, I want you to be beautiful and give me a son.
Yep.
So like, my first impression of him was like, oh, I like you, because he was like, I promise you we will always be equals. My kingdom is now your kingdom. But you do have to trust me, and I'm not going to make it easy for you because first of all, I'm not going to show you my face. And second of all, I can't tell you everything about the world because...
I actually can't.
Yeah, I literally cannot because...
Some kind of magic or curse or I don't even know.
Well,
something with the moon.
So his kingdom is between the human world and the other world. He does tell her that. But then he says that at the new moon, his realm... Like, he won't be controlled because the other realms won't bind him to silence on that particular day. It's like the one time where he can kind of speak the truth without being bound by the other realms. So she has to wait until this new moon to kind of get the full story. And he's like, in the meantime, please just trust me. Which I would not be super comfortable about that, especially since this world that he lives in is so mysterious. And also just like, I thought this was so wildly creative and original. Like, first he takes her to the Night Bazaar, which was in her story, where there are like creatures selling daydreams and nightmares and selling like a good night's sleep. And it was kind of like this goblin market, like a fairy market where you're bartering for strange things. And the descriptions were so beautiful, like the kid with the vulture wings and like the woman with the peacock tails. There were like 10 feet mice and small elephants. And I thought that was just really a cool scene.
It was. That would be like, well, there's so much in this actually that I would love to see on film, or like just like, you're right. It was such a beautiful, unique, really magical place that it just, it's fun to like live in that, and it would be cool to see it more. It kind of reminded me of Caraval a little bit.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
I was literally just going to say that it reminds me so much of Caraval, which I loved that series.
Yeah, the setting for sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I hope we come back to the Night Bazaar.
But even, I mean, beyond the Night Bazaar, even this kingdom. So she goes to the kingdom of Acheron, and first she notices that the entire place is empty, right? The kingdom is like completely void.
Except for Gupta.
That's true. Gupta's there, the advisor. But aside from that, there's really no living thing there, which she notices. So like even the flowers are like glass, and there's mirrors everywhere that show glimpses of like other realms. So like she'll look in a mirror and see like a totally different landscape that she could, I think, potentially travel to.
Yeah.
And then I love that Amar is like, be careful in this palace because it's going to try and test you, which is like, I love the idea that like this palace is its own character, kind of. It's kind of like its own living thing where it's like, he's like, don't follow the sounds, you're gonna hear voices, some doors will open to you, but the ones that are locked for a reason. It's very cool.
Okay, but this is where I start to get frustrated a little bit, because I know that he can't tell her some things. He, like, can't talk when he tries to explain certain things. I get that. But I feel like he could give her more information than he does. Between him and Gupta, I feel like they give her so little to go off of. And again, I get that they can't tell her everything or can't answer some of her specific questions. But especially with his whole thing about, like, try and look at things from a different perspective. I'm like, you couldn't creatively give her a little more information somehow, or like, I don't know.
That to me was like the biggest giveaway that Amar is like up to no good.
Yeah, right? How can you trust him?
Yeah, because I was like, okay, you could be telling her more. And then for me, the second one was when he asks for a lock of her hair in the Garden of Glass. And he was like, oh, can I just like please casually just have a lock of your hair? And like, I get that that was like maybe a common thing that you'd wear like your lover's hair in some kind of charm, but I was just like, oh, don't give him a piece of yourself. Like, he's, something's gonna happen. You're gonna be bound to him in some awful way. Like,
well, and because he was so obsessed with her, and I think that he knows her from a previous life, but to, at first I was like, oh, they are soulmates, and like, this is them being reunited. She just doesn't remember. But then I started thinking, like, no, I don't think they are soulmates. I think he's like, doesn't want her to fully remember, because I sort of feel like it's one-sided affection, and he's like enjoying while she doesn't know any better and loves him back. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. I think he totally is using her.
Yeah.
I mean, I think all of this is an act, and maybe eventually we'll find out that like, oh, actually I have fallen for you, whatever. But for now, it's a total act. I mean,
he needs her.
He's enchanting her by like showing her the star room. I'm going to give you a constellation to wear in your hair. And then when he, even when he's like, he was like, oh, I interpreted your horoscope differently. Like, yes, I know everyone said that you bring destruction everywhere you go, but destruction can also make way for regrowth. And so I was like, oh, he has something planned where like he needs this particular.
He needs the destruction. Yeah.
He needs Maya, and he needs her to destroy something so he can rebuild something.
Also, okay, I agree that there can be beauty and rebirth from destruction. And, like, sometimes you need to burn things down or whatever. But, like, it's still destroyed. Part of me also was like, this didn't actually like change it. It's just like thinking a little bit longer term or something.
Yeah, and then it also makes me wonder, like, why does he need her too? Like, what, like, who is he up against? Yeah. Because he mentions, like, briefly that his job is a guardian of sorts, where he has to maintain balance between the realms, but not everyone wants balance. Like, there's some people who want chaos. So I'm just like, okay, who are these people who want chaos? Mm-hmm. And, like, how does your plan fit into this? And like, who is your enemy, essentially? Because, like, even in the palace, like, we do start hearing voices pretty quickly. And there's one that says, I know the monster in your bed. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I don't trust Amar, but I also don't know if I trust the voices either.
Yeah, I don't know who's good. And it could, Amar's biggest thing could just be that he's been lying and manipulative. I'm not convinced at this point, but, like, I could see that playing out a certain way. And he really is, like, mostly a good guy, but, like, should have communicated differently up front. I think even if that's true, it's going to take us a while to get back there. But yeah. Really, I think he's probably more bad. But, yeah, I agree. There's no, like, clear good side. Like, even her dad, who's not even part of this anymore, like, I'm not even sure if he's a good guy. You know, like, I really don't know if there's anyone that I would be, like, besides herself. And it's going to be interesting to see her kind of, as she's coming into her power, getting more information, how she uses that and what she decides to stand for, or who she decides to stand with.
That's a really good point that I don't trust anyone in this book right now aside from Maya. And I also am not clear on who is quote unquote the villain and who is not. Like, even Mother mm-hmm. Dina, I was so sure she was like the villain. And then all of a sudden she, at the end, remember, she was like, keep some secrets for yourself. And I was like, oh, yep. That's interesting advice. Like, why are you giving her this? Like, are you actually trying to be helpful?
Does she know more?
Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is, like, kind of a cool place to be in a book. Like, it's making me really curious to keep reading.
I agree. I kind of like when I can't fully predict. I mean, we know that I predict terribly wrong all the time anyways, but right now I'm not even like, I don't know if they end up together or anything. Like, I don't know if this is her true love interest and they just have to work through their communication problems, or if they're going to be, like, battling and one of them dies at the end. I don't know.
Right, because there's so much ambiguity, which is great. Yeah. Like, even Amar, like, yeah, I'm going to treat you like an equal. I'm going to leave you alone until you want me to touch you. Like, he's like, doing the right things. And so I'm just like, okay, I don't completely hate you, but I also don't know what you're up to and cannot trust you.
Yeah.
What do you think of the tapestry?
Oh, I love that. I actually wish we would spend more time there. I think that is so interesting because I'm already kind of have mixed feelings, but I'm, like, very intrigued by the idea of fate and, like, choice and, like, how things work. And I sort of just love the way it, like, pulls her in and out, and, like, the way they can, like, I like how it brought this idea of fate as a thread into an actual tapestry, and, like, the physicality of the tapestry versus what's happened. Like, I'm actually very intrigued by this, and I hope it, like, continues to be something we see, but I still have a lot of questions.
Do you think that the whole, like, at the heart of it was he takes this boy whose name is Vikram and he has a thread with two ends, essentially, or two...
Yeah, frame in two ways.
Two paths, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was like, okay, there's two fates that can play out. In one, he becomes a prince and he has, like, a legacy and he eventually wins peace for his kingdom, but it's like, hard won and it's accomplished, like, by not being violent or anything.
Yep.
And then the other one is he becomes a mercenary and it's like he wins peace quickly through warfare, but also, like, doesn't have a legacy. And he basically says, like, okay, you have to choose the thread that affords the best outcome for the most amount of people, and, like, that's how we control balance. Mm-hmm. And I was a little confused about what happened when she made the decision, because she chooses the path where the boy becomes a prince, even though more people will die, because she thinks that the peace will be, like, longer lasting. But then she goes to, like, pull the thread and it doesn't move. And Amar's like, oh, it's because you don't believe in your powers. But then she tries again and it was a little bit confusing.
I agree. And actually, like, her magic or her power coming to her, I think in part because she doesn't fully understand it. And then like she sort of goes in and out of consciousness and memory also. Mm-hmm. And even though it's like so beautiful and some things I can totally picture, that scene, I agree, I had trouble kind of figuring out what all was happening. And similarly, the one when they were in with the stars and she was like manipulating the darkness and pulling the stars together, for some reason I had trouble like kind of picturing all the movement in my head. So there are some of this is just like almost so fantastical that I like can't quite get there.
I totally agree. Like when she was trying to like lasso the stars, I was like, I'm not following.
Yeah,
it is beautiful, but I'm also just like, I can't follow the action of the book.
Yeah, like I thought the room was beautiful, but I didn't understand how she ultimately did lasso the stars fully.
And what happened to the tapestry? Like, did she choose the path for the boy?
So I think she ended up not being able to do either one. So even though she made a decision, she like couldn't execute it.
Okay.
But then I was also confused because it was like in that moment that she did get her power. So shouldn't that have like allowed her to
triggered something? Do it? I guess they do say that like it's a start, I guess. But I did feel like all of a sudden she had powers and she and Amar were just like throwing arrows around. Like that part, that was a little jarring for me because I was like, oh my god, all of a sudden she like has her powers and they're just like casually throwing things back and forth using their magic. And I was like, what? Where did this come from?
Yeah, we should have a little more explanation or like training with words or something. It reminded me though of like, oh, what is that? The Sword and the Stone or something. I know it wasn't really like that, but just like throwing things and then like changing it into something else and throwing it. I don't know. Something about it just seemed like kind of like a funny learning magic silly scene.
I just feel like she should have been more alarmed by it or more like amazed by it.
Yeah, or even just like, let me try some things, not just like, okay, I'll do what you asked me to do specifically. Asking questions. She has so many questions. Yeah, you would think that like that would be a big thing.
Yeah, I was a little confused. I thought maybe that was a little unbelievable for me. But all the doors open, though, when she comes into her powers. So that's where she finds the tree in the room with the chains on it, right?
The memory tree. Mm-hmm.
And it has a tree that contains all of her memories.
But, like, literally from a different life.
Yeah, and that's what was confusing to me because I think you're right. Like, I think they are from a different life, but how would she recognize them as hers?
I know, I wanted her to say more about that because I think she said something just like literally like what you just said where she was like, even though it wasn't me, I knew it was me or something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I was like, but how? But why?
She was like, oh, they're my memories, but none of them look familiar to me. And I was like, wait. But yeah, that makes sense. That would totally make sense if they were hers from a different life, so.
I also like almost wanted, maybe this would be too cliche, but like, you know, in a book, like if she always like twirls her hair or like has like just a weird quirk that they've mentioned a few times throughout the story. And then like we see in the memories, like the main memory person doing the same thing
or
something
herself.
Like that to like connect it. But that didn't happen in this book. But that's kind of what I was like expecting or hoping for, like some kind of tell.
So yeah, this is why we learn that like Amar can't be trusted because he really like came to the palace to rescue her because he needs to use her powers for something.
Yeah, but again, and it could be ultimately a good thing. Who knows?
It could be. I mean, the one thing that makes me a little wary is that at the very end of this chapter that we read up to, she sees a bunch of dead people walking through the palace and then puts it together that she's actually in Naraka, the land of the dead, which if you look at is Acheron spelled backwards.
Oh, I didn't even put that together.
Yep. So Amar is actually the king of the dead in the afterlife. And then she has that moment where she realizes that her horoscope came true because she is partnered with death. And the last scene of this gave me chills. Like when she finds Amar and he's sitting in front of the tapestry and he's just yanking out the threads by handfuls. And like, you know that all the threads are people.
Yeah.
That like, that was like such a good image that like really stayed with me because it was just so horrifying. Like you have the moment where you realize who he is, what he's doing, and then he's like tearing the threads out of the tapestry. Ooh, I love it.
But I think this is just where I just am, like, so suspicious of everything. Like, as she was falling in love with him, I was, like, suspicious that he was a bad guy. And, like, as he was lying and she was kind of, like, accepting it, I was like, I don't know, I don't know. But now that she, like, sees he's the death or whatever, God, part of me is like, okay, but maybe, again, we saw, like, the tapestry, like, the really almost impossible choice, like, choosing between two, you know, I mean, there's downsides to every choice that's made. And part of me is like, well, maybe it's more complicated than we see right now. And even though it seems like he's doing these terrible things, maybe it's to prevent something even more terrible. Or maybe it, like, I don't know. So I almost, like, as he gets more obviously bad, I start to go back the other way where I'm like, no, I think he's secretly good.
He might be.
But I definitely, they, like, so many couples in YA novels need to work on their communication style for sure. And at a minimum, like, she shouldn't trust him, and he's lied to her and used her, and she needs a lot more information about what's going on, and I hope she doesn't just do whatever he says next. I hope she's not easily won over by whatever he says.
I don't think she will be, because I think she's starting to learn, like, that she is powerful and she should listen to her own voice, and...
Yeah, but I'm worried she's going to listen to some voice in the castle that's even worse than, you know, I don't know. I want to see, like, whoever the intruder was in her room, or, like, whatever that was, come back into it somehow.
And what are they trying to warn her about?
Yeah. He is showing his face to her now, right? Or did he just do it the one time? Is he still covering his head most of the time?
I think he is. And that was weird, too. Because Gupta was like, oh, he's not showing you his face because it will reveal all of his emotions.
And then when he did, because he did show it to her, and she was like, I didn't get anything. I was like, if it's supposed to reveal everything, at least let it reveal something.
She was like, yeah, he still has a pretty good poker face, as far as I can tell. What did you research this week?
So I sort of, okay, well, I guess I should tell our listeners, part of the reason why we've been a little bit slower to post recently is because I am pregnant and I've been dealing with all the new fun things that my body is doing because of that, and it's made things harder. So I also just, like, can't focus as well or something. Yeah. So I, like, kept, like, I opened so many tabs, but, like, don't really have a good story for you. But one thing I pulled up was the 10 laws of reincarnation.
Ooh.
Because I guess there's, like, karmic laws that help determine what your next life is, or, like, whatever your soul needs to, like, bring balance back. Mm. So I know high level reincarnation, the idea of, like, if you do good in this life, you'll, like, come back in a better life. If you do bad in this life, you'll come back in a worse life kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know a ton about how all of that worked. So I just thought these were kind of interesting. So there's a law of continuation, which is that basically you have to keep learning the same lesson over and over again until you master it in totality. So, like, you'll, especially love, I think is, like, the main lesson you're supposed to learn. So over many lifetimes, you'll, like, continue to, like, encounter the same thing until you figure it out.
Oh, I love that.
And then there's the law of expanse, which means you get taught through experiencing life from every point of view. So if you, like, hate a person, or a person, like, based on something stupid, like, you know, you hate poor people, or you hate a certain nationality, or you hate the sick or something like that, then your next experience, like, that's what you'll be reincarnated into. So each individual is supposed to experience both genders, all races, all nationalities, all religions, well, ill, rich, poor, success, failure, etc. And that allows you to see, like, the value and worthiness of all types of life.
Everyone. Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really cool.
Wow. That's really cool.
And then there's the law of consequence. So basically you learn by experiencing cause and effect, by interacting with a community of other individuals that you constantly reincarnate with, who assume different roles in each new life.
Oh, do you think we knew each other in a previous life?
I mean, we must have. That's the only.
Yeah.
Otherwise, why would we have 4 years of a podcast? I think we probably did the first, what was, like, the podcast of the Roman? I don't know. I'm just kidding.
We started the first podcast. I feel like now I want to know, like, who were we to each other in previous lives?
Right? I know. I did try and look up, like, can I find out anything about my previous life? And I think there are, like, some different quizzes you can take that are probably, like, complete BS. But I did see something that was, like, whatever your... Because I was looking at star charts, too. Mm. And I guess your, like, traditional astrological sign is related to your karmic astrological sign.
Oh.
So what is your... What's your horoscope sign?
So I'm a Leo.
Okay, let's see what it says about that. So I think ascendant is your current sign. So with Leo as your ascendant sign, karmic astrology associates your past life with Cancer. So as a Cancer, you had deep emotions, fears, and insecurities about existence, and everything mm-hmm. in your life revolved around loving and being loved. So you were maybe like in some kind of caring role, like a midwife or a mother superior, they said. And so now, in this incarnation, as a Leo, you feel confidently romantic and you want to share a passionate love with someone. But you tend to be self-centered. So your karmic task this time is to develop, without egocentrism, worthy lion qualities and to overcome the fear of being abandoned from your past life.
Ooh, I love that.
And so I'm a Capricorn, so my karmic sign was Sagittarius. So in a previous life, they think I was some kind of like professor, lawyer, ship's captain, world traveler, or actor. So that sounds awesome.
Oh my God, you were a pirate prince. It makes so much sense.
Yeah, so that explains everything.
It really does.
So like basically my life previously was all about like fun and adventure and whatnot. And so now as a Capricorn, I'm trying to take life more seriously and like take responsibility and pursue more worthy ambitions. So like discipline and hard work are what I need to like learn in this lifetime.
Whoa.
So I thought that was kind of, I don't know. Like, again, I don't even know if I'm looking at the right things entirely. I kept like kind of jumping around, but I like this idea of reincarnation and how it works with karma and sort of what the quote unquote rules are, just because it's not part of my like Catholic upbringing at all, I thought was like really interesting. So I kind of had fun.
I love the karmic horoscope. I had never really heard of your karmic ones. Mm-hmm. So that is like, I'm going to do so much more research tonight on that.
I know. I should have looked into it more. It had something to do with like, it's the 12th sign in your calendar. So it does Leo come right after Cancer? Is that true?
Yeah.
So I think it's like you move through the calendar.
You move through the zodiac.
Yeah.
That is so awesome.
And again, take all this with a grain of salt. And if this is your belief, I probably completely butchered it and I apologize, but I love some of the ideas here. And I love the idea of part of the reincarnation cycle related to karma is this idea of like experiencing life from all these different points of views and like relearning the same lesson, or, you know, getting taught the same lesson until you learn it, and like kind of having this community that like moves through the lives with you. And it just kind of like brings this whole idea of like your lives are connected mm-hmm. to another level, I think.
Well, isn't it true? Like, I don't know. There's something weird, too, about, like, how whenever you meet people, like, sometimes you meet people and you just click with them. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a weird thing. And then you meet some people where you're, like, you are doing nothing wrong. There's absolutely nothing wrong with you. But for some reason, like, I'm just not connecting with you.
Yeah.
And it just makes me think, like, there has to be some kind of, like, previous life involved in how we feel about each other.
I totally. And I, like, don't really believe in that. Don't believe, but I don't think of soulmates as like your one true love as much as I think like I have soul friends, or like people that kind of like what you were saying, like there's yeah. people in my life who I just like am supposed to know.
Yeah.
And we would have found each other one way or the other. And yeah, like, I mean, what are the odds that we would have like worked in completely different departments at like a industrial supply company and we like met on the first day and like now
yeah. and with neither of us being from Chicago, like both transplants.
Yeah.
Both at a huge company. Like, it's karma. It's fate.
I think so. And I love to think of it like that.
Me too.
Anyways, what did you research?
Oh, so I researched a little bit about the Svayamvara that Maya had.
Okay, good. I want to hear more about that.
I didn't do, like, a ton of research, but I thought I just wanted to look into it a little bit more. So in ancient India, it was the practice of a bride choosing a groom or choosing a husband from a variety of men who were chosen ahead of time.
So how much did she interact with them all? Like, was it kind of like in this thing where they just each introduced themselves?
I think it depends. So it was something you did for a young woman of marriageable age belonging to a noble family, and she had to choose her spouse in the presence of her family members, like her parents and her family members. So essentially, they would basically presented their credentials, I guess, to the bride-to-be. So they would be kind of chosen by the family for certain traits, either like, you know, personal interests, financial status, lineage, reputation, their standing in community, that kind of thing. And this was probably...
And so just to clarify, it's not like, hey, I'm having, like, my daughter's ceremony tomorrow, like, whoever wants to come on by. It's, like, specifically, like, you get an invitation.
Yes, yes. So basically it was, you would kind of learn about eligible men through word of mouth, and let's say it was probably circulated via word of mouth, and then through this information, the bride's family would have a basic idea of who to invite to the ceremony. Mm-hmm. However, the bride only saw the suitors face-to-face on the day of the ceremony.
Okay.
So it's kind of similar to an arranged marriage where, like, you know, your parents would basically go out and through word of mouth or through meeting with other people would find a young man or a young woman who you thought would be a good match. You know, they're not just, like, going out there finding anyone and bring them in. Like, I think they really did do their research to say, like, who do we think would be compatible? And then they would gather all of them together in a room, and it was a formal invitation. And they would pick a date and time for the main ceremony that was, like, auspicious. And either the bride could announce her choice immediately, or sometimes there was, like, a competition involved between the suitors.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. And so there's a couple of variations where, like, you know, sometimes the suitors all have to perform a test that's, like, a test of strength or something like that, or something that would reveal their character a little bit more too, just to kind of maybe make one stand out from the others.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there were multiple men there that the bride could choose from, she did have to put her garland around the neck of the man she chose to marry. Like, she did have to make a choice. So
okay, she couldn't just say none of these are good enough.
None of these good. Yeah, she did have to make a choice. So a lot of people said, like, oh, this is kind of good because it's kind of like a symbol of women's empowerment. Like, you're giving power back to the bride, allowing her to choose her husband. But she is choosing from a curated list, let's say.
Yeah, limited. It's like a choice, but is it?
Right. So the most famous Svayamvara is in the Indian epic, the Ramayana. And in this epic, there was a king who had a Svayamvara for his daughter Sita. And he sent out a royal invitation to all the princes and kings that were allies to his kingdom. And they set up a test of courage for the suitors. So they were asked to string a sacred bow. And Lord Rama was the only one present who was able to string this bow. And that's why Sita picked him as her husband.
So I have another question for you. Is this still done even, like, in a modified way in parts of India or parts of the world today? Or is this an old tradition now?
I don't know.
Because I know arranged marriage has kind of, like, changed a little bit, but it's not, like, certain people still choose that path.
Sure. I'm not sure if this is something that's still practiced today.
It kind of sounds like, I mean, like, you could argue The Bachelorette is kind of like a modified version of this.
That's true, but they're all picked by Chris Harrington.
Yeah, instead of your parents, it's the producers, and they want the best TV, not the best match for you. And you're not actually required to pick one at the end, but it's a little bit kind of like that.
And there's a lot more challenges involved that are slightly more humiliating than stringing a bow.
Yeah, like the reality TV version of that, maybe.
So what's interesting is Svayamvara comes from the Sanskrit word svayam, which means self, and vara, which means groom. So it's basically like choosing the groom for myself, which I kind of liked.
And I do, I mean, like, because you could, in theory, have the opposite, right? Like the guy choosing a girl out of a group of women. But I do like, again, it's not 100% great because you don't have true, like, any mm-hmm. option in the world, but it does put a little bit of power back on the woman's side, especially in certain times and cultures where, like, they really didn't have much say otherwise.
Yeah. And, I mean, the issue, too, is that, like, oftentimes this was, like, a really young woman, so, like, 16, 17. She could be even younger. But the suitors could be any age. So they could be like 21 or they could be 50. They could have multiple wives. They could have other children. I think a lot of it came down to like your lineage, your caste, like, you know, things like that. And she's not allowed to reject. When she chooses a husband, she's not allowed to go back on her word. So yeah, there is a lot of family preference really does play a strong part.
And good first impressions that hide terrible traits.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I just wanted to research it a little bit more because I didn't really know anything about it.
It would be like, I mean, I love my husband. Everything worked out the way it was supposed to. But sometimes I'm like so curious if my parents had the option to choose certain things for me, like what they would have picked.
Oh my gosh. I know my mom would not have picked Chad. Which is funny because she loves him to death now. Like, she's obsessed with him. But I remember when we were dating, she was just like, we met him, like, for some reason in a store. And afterwards, she was like, are you sure about this guy? Yes. And now, like, he is far and away her favorite person in, like, the entire world.
That's so funny. Yeah. I kind of feel like, not quite that extreme, but, like, I mean, even I, like, on paper, I feel like my husband, if you asked me like 5 years ago and you like listed out all the things I like love about him now, I would have been like, no, I'm not interested at all. You know, and like I feel like my parents, if they met like this car guy who doesn't read that much, who like, I don't know, they just would have been like, no, probably not for Katie, but
yeah, we'll pass. Don't put that girl in around him.
But yeah, now and my whole family loves him, but it's just funny how things work out sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what else do we have to do? We just have to keep reading, and I really want to keep reading.
Yeah, I know. And this is only a duology, so I feel like things are going to keep happening fast. I mean,
yes.
Like, hopefully we get some good answers in not too much longer.
Oh, I hope so.
And I think it's going to keep getting bigger. Like, I feel like we're going to leave Acheron again and, like, see more of the three worlds.
Oh.
Like, the other world and the human world as well.
That would be really cool, actually.
Yeah, I want to go. And I hope that I feel like her sister relates somehow. Like, that's going to come back around at some point.
Yeah. And I want to know more about her mom.
Oh, yes. I agree. And I want to know who this intruder is. Are they one of the voices in the castle, or were they just someone else? Is it related to her mom?
Probably.
I don't know.
No. Well, let's keep reading and find out. In the meantime, whose turn is it to tell a joke?
Oh, I don't know whose turn it is.
I don't either. I have a joke.
Okay. You go.
Okay. Why do nurses like red crayons? This is so dumb.
I have no idea. I don't even have a guess.
Because sometimes they have to draw blood.
Oh, I wish that was what they did for that. So dumb. Oh my goodness. I actually heard a joke on the radio the other day that made me think of you.
Save it for next week.
Okay. Yeah, I need to remember it too so I don't accidentally give it away. I have a bad habit of like, if I didn't look it up, getting the punchline as part of the joke. So I'll have that one ready for next week.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at mnktalkya@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on Instagram or Facebook at mnktalkya. And you should tell us if you think you knew us in a previous life.
Yeah. Or what you need to work on in this life. Mine is to be less selfish.
I just need to keep working hard. Have no fun. I'm just kidding.
Katie's is to remember all of her dad jokes.
Less dad jokes, more editing. I'm just kidding. Yeah, we'll see you all next week. Bye, bookworms.
Go get a library card.
M&K Talk YA is produced and edited by Marissa Snyder and Katie Bradford. Original music composition by Timothy Milkey. Logo design by Marissa Snyder. For updates and extras, visit mnktalkya.com or follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And if you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. We would like to thank James Tobias, Chad Snyder, Meredith Kelfie, and Michael Howard for all of their support. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.